Amen. All right. We are going to finish up the Roman history stuff today, and next week we'll start talking about Roman society for the 2 days leading up to the oral exam. At the end of today's class, what we're going to do is I should be able to get through Julius Caesar's reign, moving into the second triumvirate, and then talk about the accomplishments of Augustus. And then I want to hear from you guys about your particular emperor and about the different characterizations of them, about what you found and things of that nature, so that we can kind of start filling in the first century time period. Does that make sense? So if you don't remember your emperor, that's a bad thing, because I want you to. Nathan. I know good Roman history authors, I could tell you. One of the best Roman historians in the past 100 years is a guy named Michael Grant. He's fantastic. His stuff's really good. Where did this stuff come from, though? I mean, you have Martin Goodman that's kind of he kind of blurs over in the New Testament world and Roman world. He's written a book called The Roman World from, 40 BC to 180 AD. That's a pretty good resource. That was actually the book that was stolen in my car and then I got back later. Anyway, it doesn't matter. The Oxford Classical Dictionary is awesome. I'm trying to think of other people. I mean, it depends on what area of Roman history you're talking about. Like the Remus and Romulus myth, T.P. Wiseman's kind of the expert in that area. When you're talking military strategies, what's the guy's name? It's called The Grand Strategy of the Roman Empires, a book that really kind of launched off the whole discussion of the Roman military strategy and then has been critiqued later on. I don't remember who wrote that one now. Guy by the name of J.P.V.D. Balsden wrote Roman Enemy, Rome and Its Enemies, something along those lines. Lady named Susan Mattern, she's written some good stuff as well. When you're talking like Roman Triumphs, Mary Beard, and she actually has written a lot on Roman religions as well. She's considered one of the best Roman historians in the U.K. today, which if it's in the U.K., it probably means in the world. Mary Beard. Off the top of my head, those would be some names I think that help you get moving. And honestly, the way that you study the Roman world is the same way that you study any book of the Bible. Is you find a book, start reading, who are they interacting with? Start getting up journal articles, who are they interacting with? And then you move from there to figure out who you need to be interacting with. But definitely Michael Grant, Mary Beard. But again, they all have their niches. It's just like New Testament. Just like biblical studies. Good question. Any other questions? I didn't say those too quick, did I? Or do you need spelling on any of those, anybody? Mattern, M-A-T-T-E-R-N. Susan Mattern. Any other questions on that? All right, we talked about last class the first triumvirate, which was composed of what three figures? Julius Caesar. Crassus. Pompey, exactly. And how did they form? What caused them to form their allegiance? The snubs of the Senate. Exactly right. Each of them had their particular issues, and the Senate snubs all of them, primarily by which character? Cato. That guy will rear his head here in a bit again. I'm looking down at the wrong notes. Whenever Caesar's elected, they have all these different things where he starts pushing the agendas of the triumvirate that weren't being able to push because they were blocked. He starts using forceful tactics to implement what he wants, even by bypassing the Senate, like beating up his fellow consul, etc. The second triumvirate begins to diminish in around 56 BC. Well, no, that's whenever they solidify second triumvirate, although from that it begins to deteriorate. 54 is a major point when they deteriorate because Pompey's wife Julia dies, which was Julius Caesar's daughter. And instead of reestablishing the marriage relationship, this is actually important because we're going to see this develop once again in the second triumvirate, which is pretty ironic and unique. But Pompey rejects Caesar's proposal of marrying somebody else related to him. He marries Cornelia instead, whom Metellus Scipio, it was his daughter. So you start to see the deterioration of the first triumvirate. 53 BC, Crassus gets killed in his Parthian Wars, which he was trying to gain more recognition. And 49 BC, because Pompey was given control by the Senate to make war against Caesar, Caesar marches his army across the Gaul and Italy border, declaring war on Rome, something that hadn't happened since what figure? What's that? No. Sulla. The civil war in around 88. And what did Sulla ultimately accomplish whenever in 88, the second time he marched on Rome? Yes, he became the dictator for a time period in which he actually did end up giving it back. All these are important because these are all laying down elements that eventually the second triumvirate, whenever we have an actual success, we have an incipient success with what happens with Julius Caesar, but the ultimate success happens with Octavian. We'll get to that in a bit. Julius Caesar, though, finally wipes out, in 48, wipes out Pompey's army. Pompey gets killed by the Egyptians, which they will play a part in this story here in just a bit as well, with a woman by the name of Cleopatra. And ultimately, whenever he gets declares a victory, Caesar takes the title of what? Imperator, which means the military commander who surpasses all others. Exactly. And eventually, etymologically, that's where we get the word emperor. But right now, notice the connections with it. Imperator, the emperor, is connected to military conquest. Okay? That's why even on some of the coins that we've looked at, you'd see the IMP that was on some of the coins. Imperator. And it is emperor, but it's really also talking about their military conquest. It's an honorific term that points to military victories. Honor they gained from that. Okay, now we're going to talk about the reign of Julius Caesar. So Julius Caesar has successfully decimated the triumvirate through his different machinations, and ultimately his true goal comes out in seizing the power of the empire. What we initially notice whenever Caesar takes power is that he's not just a genius when it comes to military, but he's also a genius when it comes to administration. Although, even though he administratively was incredibly good, we will find that Octavian takes it to a whole new level whenever he takes power, but that's by and by. Several different things that Caesar immediately began to do to try to secure the power that he had achieved, good enough. Number one, the first action that Caesar does, let's see, can you guess? What would be the first action he would do? Maybe. He has done a bunch of that already with his army wiping out Pompey. He gets back into power. What's the first thing you think he's going to try and do? Maybe establish it. All these are getting to the different area. Where is his key area of power right now, though? The military. What do you think he would do? Yeah, reward them. Exactly. That's the very first thing he does. It starts giving out land and rewards to his soldiers that have helped him secure his victory. Because ultimately, what does that do? Yes, their allegiance is to him. They not only fight for him, they die for him, but he takes care of them. And as a result, it solidifies his power. So that if he needs to call on them again, then the gifts that he's given them would secure that relationship, the patron-client relationship, which we'll talk about that more next week. Number two, and this is something he's learned from past either people attempting to be emperor or even the triumvirate. The second thing that Julius Caesar does is he starts giving out Roman citizenship very liberally to individuals, key individuals, not just to mass groups. He gets key individuals because the key individuals having that type of relationship with the emperor once again secures an honor relationship that he could tap into later if he needed to. See what he's doing? Make sure his key source of power, the military, is taken care of. They belong to him. Then he starts going to the strategic people that give citizenship around the region so that now they belong to him. And then he develops it a third way. This is really Caesar's major claim to fame next. This is going to sound minute, but it's huge. Caesar cures the unmanageable problem of the financial debt of the Republic. The Republic as a whole, they were just, when it came to their fiscal responsibility, they were atrocious. And what Caesar does is he comes in and he starts to manage the debt in a way where it pulls the empire not in financial woes, but puts them in a position of financial growth. And that's very significant because what he does is he starts creating where lending and borrowing can start once again happening, which is, we know from our just recent economic woes that's one of the major things that the government's been pouring tons of money back into. The banks, the borrowing and lending. Why? Because that generates economy. That really, and that makes a lot of people, actually not a lot of people, that makes some people very wealthy. And ultimately, if Caesar is the one responsible for stimulating the economy of the empire once again to the point where it's back in repairs, and he's made some people very rich, what does that do? It solidifies his power. All these different things, he's accomplished something that the Republic could not. Making, once again, the empire economically feasible. And number four, and this again, brilliant, brilliant tactic. Those spoils of war that he received, whenever he got it, he didn't just use it to pad his pockets. He began to put it into the city and into the people. He used his financial gains, his own personal ones, to build buildings and to beautify the city, which would once again endear the people to him. These four tactics that he does begins to develop a popularity that's just exploding. And you really see the popularity explode in two different ways. Number one, for the very first time in the history of the Roman Empire, the face of a living person appears on a coin. Very first time. And that is more than significant. Why? Say it again. Propaganda. And number one, it's just perpetuating the myth of himself. What else? What else does somebody say?
Becomes influential later, like because of the view of Rome.
Absolutely. Absolutely, because eventually we saw the way Nero, it's the way he communicates even his benevolence, even if he doesn't have any. It's the way that he lets everybody know who it is that they're worshiping, the divine son, Caesar, the imperator. It's a major propaganda tool. But also the fact that his face appears on it puts him in the lineage of some pretty honorific characters. Because up until that point, the characters that appeared on it were the faces of either Roman legendary heroes like Romulus or the gods. Something very significant is being stated whenever he says, and now, my face. And in 44 BC, people are going, yeah, okay, that's cool. That's cool, kind of. We'll get to that in a minute. The second thing that you can see his popularity exploding, primarily through those four different avenues we've already talked about, is not just through coins, but through the statuary. The amount of statues that just explode with the head of Caesar all across the empire shows that what he was able to do was to perpetuate his own personal cult. His personality cult would be the more accurate term. People wanted, his presence was everywhere. Whether it was on the coins people were paying stuff with, or whether it was on the statues that decorated their cities. Caesar's presence was everywhere. This began to develop, though, the development of the word really emperor, or the office emperor. Because up until this point, we have had Sulla implement not the word emperor, but the word dictator. Sulla has held this. Matter of fact, he held it for 8 years, from 88 to 80. Ultimately, in 80, he gives it back and then dies in 78. Nevertheless, this is the word that's been attached to people so far. And so, it also was attached to Caesar initially. Caesar gets the title of dictator with the condition that he would rule as dictator the same way Sulla did. Which was what? What were the caveats? Whenever Sulla took dictatorship, what was the caveats? Yes, that he would take control so he could reform everything and ultimately give it back to the Senate. That was the initial agreement. And so that happens in 49 BC where he gets the role of dictator. And year after year he's elected. It's a yearly thing. Every year they'd have to re-elect him as the dictator for the next year. In 46, what happens is that Caesar pushes and people agree to elect him as dictator not for the next year, but for the next 10 years. And all of a sudden you see a development. Then, what happens in 44 BC, we've already used the word or the date 44 BC to refer to what? The first time the coin was minted. In that same year, and this is what was on the coin. See, it was also suggested that Caesar take the title dictator for life. And he said, yeah, I agree. Matter of fact, I'll put it on my coins. What do you think that'll do? Sociologically speaking, how do you think people will react to that? Say it. Depends on which people. Exactly right. So, help me, let's divvy it up. Which people would react in what ways?
Although the lower class would not like that.
The lower, why wouldn't the lower class like that?
Not like that.
No, what, help me.
They wouldn't necessarily like the fact that he's dictating them because they're the ones who have to serve them, the ones that are living and building these things and stuff like that, while they leave the Christian population.
Possibly. Where I would push back on that would be, they're already under the hegemony of the Senate. It's not like if the power is in one man's hands or in 10 men's hands, it's really going to change their plight much. Matter of fact, if depending on what he does, like, you know, for example, you see they were really excited about the one man with Gracchus, because Gracchus was going to give them land and allow them to be a part of the military, which would give them dignity. Therefore, they would be totally cool with one man ruling if that's what he was going to do. You see the issue? But how would, let's look at the other class. We just split it up in a reductionalistic terms, lower class, higher class. How would they respond?
Powers out of their hands.
Say it again?
Powers out of their hands for the life of
Israel. Yeah, all of a sudden, the power that they possess in any way, shape, or form now belongs to one man, and he rules over them. And they're going, yeah, I'm not so good with that. Because you were supposed to give this back once you reformed us. But now, you're saying that you just get all the power for your entire life? What does that mean after you die? Then who gets the power? Your sons? See what could be happening? And that's what starts to develop, some animosity. Around this time, around 44 BC, Caesar makes another mistake. He decides he wants more military conquest. He wants more honor. He's already had a ton. The Transalpine Gaul, you know, over in Spain. He's really done pretty well. But he wants more, because there's one person in the recent history that Caesar cannot say that he's accomplished more than when it comes to military. And that man was by the name of Alexander the Great. Caesar became obsessed with wanting to make his kingdom that he would reign beyond what Alexander the Great ever was able to accomplish. So he decided that he was going to take his military expertise into the east, into the Parthians, where who failed recently? Crassus. Where Crassus failed, Caesar says, oh, I will succeed. Matter of fact, I will succeed even more than what Alexander the Great did himself. So Caesar decides to develop this plan, and here was the major shameful issue for that particular expedition. The elite were already upset that Caesar, that one man had the power of the empire. And now this one man would be ruling in absentia. He wouldn't even be there. And they would still be subjected to him. That means his secretaries and his councilmen would be ruling the empire over the Senate whenever, because he's not even in the city. See how shameful that could be? It's one thing to be shamed by one person ruling over you. It's another thing to have that one person's assistants ruling over you. So he's like, I'm going to go on a military conquest, but I'm still the king. I'm still the imperator. I am still the dictator for life. Eventually, this starts to go to a boiling point, and they just can't take it anymore. And so what happens is, well, no, there's one more caveat. We got to put this other caveat in. At this point, too, Caesar was just too comfortable in his own shoes. Or sandals, whatever. It's just too comfortable. And Caesar thought, I have given this world so much benefit, so much peace, so much security. I stopped all the civil war, by the way. It's only been a couple years, but we'll hang my hat on that. He basically said, I don't need bodyguards anymore. I know I'm getting threats against my life. I don't need them anymore. Because he could not imagine anyone wanting him out of the way, given what he has already produced for the empire. He's like, I don't need bodyguards because people just love me too much. If they lost me, where would they be? So he disperses his bodyguards and says, I'm going to go on a military conquest. And what that ultimately does is it ticks the Senate off to the point that on March 15th, 44 BC, which is known, thank you, Shakespeare, beware of the Ides of March. Beware of the Ides of March. March 15th, 44 BC, 3 days before Caesar was supposed to leave on his military conquest in the east, the Senate called a meeting in Pompey's Theater. That should have been a clue. That should have been a clue. What happens was during that time, people like Brutus and a couple of other key leaders, they all surround him and stare him in the eyes as they all stabbed him to death. A shameful way to die, so that they wanted to make sure he could see his accusers and his assassins. So, As a result, the first emperor, well, technically emperor, people debate, was he emperor or not? Suetonius has him as the first one in the lives of the 12 Caesars, so we'll call him a Caesar and emperor. Fair? Okay. It's kind of like people will argue, was Galba, Otho, Vitellius really emperors or not, because they only reigned for so long? Suetonius includes him in his section of the 12 emperors. I'm gonna trust him. So you can't get rid of those in order to get your revelation date where you want it. Is Jeremy here? Yeah, keep that in mind. Okay. All right. Whenever the key person that's holding all the power dies, what happens? People start fighting for the power, right? People start. There's a lot of power up for grabs. Who's going to get it when it all shakes down? Two primary candidates emerge. The first one is a guy by the name of Mark Antony. But we've already seen Mark Antony before. Whenever Caesar became a rebel in the empire because of Pompey's different decisions and the Senate's empowerment of Pompey to consider Caesar a fugitive, Mark Antony was in Rome and fled Rome. He was one of Julius Caesar's right-hand men. And as a result, in 44 BC, he was also a consul, and he began to do whatever it took to try to get the power that was left over from Caesar. A couple things in particular. Number one, he began to immediately use the masses that were probably aligned with Caesar. Yeah, that wasn't a Freudian slip. It was just a verbal one. Okay. He arouses the masses in order to get revenge on the assassins. And what he successfully does is drive the different assassins into exile. Why? So that when they're out of the way, they can't claim power that he can. Number two, he begins to falsify Caesar's papers, suggesting that what Caesar had lefted, what Caesar had left was all of his power to Antony. Nevertheless, people just didn't buy it. As a matter of fact, the stiff opposition began to arise in the person of Octavian. Octavian was the adopted son. He was technically the nephew, but the adopted son of Julius Caesar. Octavian really didn't need to do anything underhanded or even use any sort of force to try to get the position of that Caesar left over, for two reasons. Number one, one of the key people that was in his side that was pushing for Octavian to become the sole ruler was a guy by the name of Cicero. Heard of him? I hope so. Otherwise, we've sorely failed you. Or if you're in Latin, Cicero. So if somebody does say Cicero, they're actually not pronouncing it wrong. We are, but we don't do that with our C's. Cicero. Cicero is a celebrated rhetorician. He was incredibly influential with the way that he wrote, the speeches that he gave. And he vehemently argued against Mark Antony, but he was in support of Octavian. And as a result, and this is the second way that Octavian didn't need to use underhanded ways, the Senate was persuaded. And they said, "You are so right." And so the Senate actually said, began to express its support to Octavian and said, "This is the guy that if someone's going to take over, this is the one." What this resulted in 43 BC is the initial war between Octavian and Mark Antony. Yes?
I think the first war, Octavian or Antony, I must have missed it.
Help me now.
Remember?
The what now?
What Mark Antony did. The second was falsifying Caesar's paper.
Yeah, the first one was he ran the assassins out of town by getting the masses on his side. Okay. Because the assassins would be one of the ones that would be key candidates to try to seize the power. So what he does, he uses the leverage of Caesar's popularity to push them out so that then he could have the opportunity to seize it. And then you have with Octavian, the first one is Cicero, one of the most influential speakers at the time, is in his corner, and he actually influences the Senate, which is the second thing, to try to get Octavian accepted as the one to take over. Charlie, did you have a question?
You answered it.
Okay. Mm-mm-mm. So in 43 BC... after these two candidates emerge, what happens is, naturally, a war starts. Octavian pretty much, he doesn't completely destroy Mark Antony initially, but he does deal a major defeat, a major blow, and Mark Antony has to flee. But when Mark Antony goes, he ends up aligning himself with a guy named Lepidus. Epaphras was a very influential military person, a political person as well, that was somewhat on the fringes of the empire, but he had so much power and influence that this was a substantial alliance. Epaphras and Mark Antony, both of them wanted the power that Octavian had, but neither one of them had the privilege of it. At this point, though, it's just Mark Antony and Epaphras, and then there's Octavian in the Senate. And guess what happens that eventually leads to the rise of the Second Triumvirate? Try to guess. What's that? Yeah. The Senate snubs Octavian. The exact details of how they snub him, we don't really know. Basically, though, they treat him like a child. And said, and it was made very clear that even though he had accomplished what they wanted, and that was there was no war going on over the power, now they have used him and they don't need him anymore. And so they snub him. And what does Octavian do? He makes amends with Mark Antony and Lepidus, and he says, we need to develop a triumvirate, kind of like my dad did. See how this works? Three of them get together, and the three of them force their way into having the Senate, sanction their alliance. The first triumvirate was not sanctioned by the state. The second one was, but the second one was sanctioned by the state because of force. And what they do is this. The first actions of this second triumvirate, everybody know who the second triumvirate is? Have I been clear on that? Mark Antony, Lepidus, and Octavian. Okay? Okay. Second triumvirate, first action they do, number one, they systematically begin to kill their enemies, which includes the mass murders of over 300 senators and 2,000 knights. They mean business. You don't go around lopping off that type of nobility if you're not trying to do one thing, and that's to seize complete power. First thing they do, mass murders. Yes? 300 senators and 2,000 knights, over. Second thing they do is they decide that we don't want Caesar's assassins just as fugitives, we want them dead. And so they go after the assassins of Caesar, and in 42 BC, they killed all of them. Third thing, Second Triumvirate's just amazing. They decide that they're not going to really play totally by the rules. They're just going to split the empire up amongst themselves. So they divide the empire up in three different ways. Number one, Mark Antony rules over the eastern provinces of the empire. The area that larger, but the area that Crassus kind of was over. Then you have Lepidus, who is over, he's in the western provinces of Spain and Africa. Honestly, some of the more insignificant areas. And then you have Octavian, who takes over the rest of the West. And they say, okay, these are the ways in which we're going to run this place. As you can imagine, the tension that was occurring inside of the Empire of Rome was building. Not only was it building between the triumvirate and the Senate, though, it was building within the triumvirate itself. They just didn't like each other very much. And so, in 36, the second triumvirate begins to dissipate. So they only really have a 7-year run before they decide, we just can't take it. One of us has to seize all the power. 36 BC, Lepidus is accused by Octavian of trying to overthrow Sicily, and to develop a rebellion against the state. As a result, Lepidus is forced into exile, and he lives the rest of his life in obscurity, and he dies in 12 BC really uneventfully. So now what happens? Now where is the power resting in the empire? Yeah, you have Antony that owns the east, and you have Octavian that owns all the west. Now it's down to two. Triumvirate is no longer there. Triumvirate served its purpose, at least for Octavian. And now Octavian begins to move to take sole control of the empire. What happens first initially is there's latent tension that begins to develop, no joke, it's so weird how history repeats itself, between these two, through public propaganda. They begin to launch smear campaigns in 33 BC. The smear campaigns really get launched by Octavian, and as a result of the things he's saying about Mark Antony trying to undercut his authority and his credibility amongst the empire, Mark Antony divorces Octavia, who is the sister of Octavian. You remember the first triumvirate? We have Pompey, who was married to Julius Caesar's daughter. She dies, he marries someone else, causes a problem. Now, because of what Octavian said about Mark Antony, he says, we're breaking off ties. He gets rid of Octavia, a very shameful thing for her. And in response to this action, Octavian publishes what is supposedly Mark Antony's will. And this is the big problem. It suggests in his will that whenever he dies, all of his power is going to be left to the foreign queen, Cleopatra. So what he's basically saying is this. Let's look at Mark Antony's will. Whenever he dies, he is going to give all the power, half of the Empire of Rome, to a foreigner, a foreign queen that he has been hanging out with a little too much. Although this is an interesting fact, Julius Caesar, we actually do know, did have a thing with Cleopatra as well. But apparently he passed it on to his right-hand man when he died as well, and Mark Antony has a thing with her as well. She's quite the seductress from what we understand. Eventually this escalates. Naturally, propaganda, smear campaigns, and a culture of war ends up developing into a war itself. A lot of different battles occur between Antony and Octavian that eventually culminates in the Battle of Actium. You will see that in a lot of different places throughout Roman literature. The Battle of Actium, which actually occurred in September of 31 BCE. So this month, September of 31 BCE, the Battle of Actium occurs. This is really a sea war, a battle at sea. And what ends up happening is basically Octavian's army just wipes the floor with Mark Antony's. They just destroy their ships. Mark Antony and Cleopatra was there with him during this war, by the way, which doesn't help his propaganda. They end up fleeing back to Egypt. And ultimately, whenever Octavian begins to hem them in, they commit suicide in Alexandria, Egypt in 30 BCE, officially ending the Second Triumvirate. As a matter of fact, some of the Roman historians even suggest that Mark Antony had already died and Cleopatra only killed herself because she didn't want to march in Octavian's Roman triumph as the key enemy leader at the very end. So she'd rather kill herself to preserve herself from that humiliation. So finally, what we have now is Augustus. Or no, excuse me, that's not true. His name is Octavian right now. That is wrong in my notes. It's not Augustus yet. Octavian has finally seized complete control of the Roman Empire. And what we see now is he also, like his uncle, is a master administrator and manipulator. But he's better. He's learned from Julius Caesar's mistakes, and he starts to develop things that will secure the power for him and not make his life threatened by those that are against him. Several different things that he does. Number one. Okay, I'm sorry, what? No, that's fine. I want to go at the pace that you guys need me to go, so by all means, stop me. That's fine. Yes, Octavian. So what we have, let me just do like a really bad history outline. You have the first triumvirate, which is made up of Pompey, Crassus, and Julius Caesar, which eventually leads to Julius Caesar taking over. He's killed by the Senate on the Ides of March, eventually leads to the fight between Mark Antony and Octavian. Octavian, supported by Cicero and the Senate, eventually leads to a war sanctioned and destroys, hits a major military defeat against Mark Antony, which causes him to align with Lepidus. Because of a snuff by the Senate, Octavian ends up developing the second triumvirate with these three fellows, with these other two guys. Okay? They come in, mass murders, 300 senators, 2,000 knights. They end up killing all the assassins and 42 of these two guys, a guy that means a lot to them, Julius Caesar. And they also then divided the empire into thirds, roughly. And what is it, 36, I think it was? Lepidus is attacked by Octavian, suggesting that he was trying to take over Sicily to develop a rebellion against the state. As a result, he's pushed into exile and he dies in obscurity in 13 to 12 BC. Eventually, at that point then, the whole empire is up for grabs for these two. He's got the east, he's got the west. Smear campaign begins with him, and around 33 BC, he responds by divorcing his wife Octavia, which was his sister. He responds then by publishing the will, supposed will. No one thinks it was real. But the will of Mark Antony, which said he was going to leave all of his power to Cleopatra, who everybody knew was his mistress. That eventually develops into a war until it culminates in the Battle of Actium, whenever Octavian's army at sea wipes out Mark Antony's. He goes back, eventually commits suicide in 30 BC, along with Cleopatra.
In 30 BC?
30 BC, right? Isn't that what I said? Yep. 30. Yeah, when they committed suicide. So they're fugitives for a couple of years. Actually, no, wait a minute. Battle of Actium's in, yeah, 1 year. September of 31 is the Battle of Actium. So there's only like, you know, however many months. 9 months maybe, maybe a year tops. Yeah. Okay? We good? Okay. Hey, by all means, stop me and make me repeat stuff like that. I'm okay with that. That's not a problem. All right? All right, the reign of Octavian. We'll get through most of this, and we'll start next class by you guys reflecting on your emperors, and then we'll move into Roman society. Reign of Octavian shows that his administrative powers was actually a lot better than... I keep pointing up here for Julius Caesar, and I don't know why. But the Julius Caesar's. Julius Caesar was good, but he made some major mistakes that Octavian's not willing to replicate. Number one, one of the things he really did well was he consistently hid his increasing power. He denigrated it. And what he used to hide it was Republican traditions. He would always point back, oh no, this is the way it's always been in the Republic. It's the way it's always been. He would point back to precedents to show that his increasing power was not a threat to the empire, but it's actually what will continue to extend the empire in the same way the Roman Republic did. He even took measures to increase the power of the Senate. But what he did was, is he reoriented where their power was. Their power was more over judicious things and not really the legislation. The things that drove the empire, he kept for himself. But he gave them power just in a different area of government. You see what he's doing? Oh, you're a significant Senate. You're not going to run the empire, but you will have a significant role. Very smart. As a result, they feel like they're gaining honor, and in reality, he's gaining more control. One of the second or third, depends on how you split up that first one. Second one, he consistently deferred overt accolades. Matter of fact, the Senate votes to establish Julius Caesar a god. They're like, he was deity, clearly. And they also wanted to do the same for Octavian. They wanted to deify Octavian while he was alive, and Octavian would not let them. No, I am not a god. I am merely a servant of the empire. Now, I will be okay with Son of God, but not God himself. Smooth. Very smooth. Very intelligent. Yes?
Can you just repeat what you called it?
Say it again?
What did you label it?
Oh, he deferred overt accolades. Accolades. An adulation, a title of honorific titles that were maybe too overt accolade. Am I spelling that right? I think so. Something like that. No. No. There you go. Yeah, he diverts overt accolades when people are saying, oh, you're a god. No, I'm not. I'm just merely the son of a god. Oh. So in denying the compliment, he actually raises his own status. Brilliant. Yes. Oh yeah, he does.
Okay.
Oh yeah, he definitely allows them to deify someone that is dead and they can't take out retribution on. And the fact that he is his successor and even adopted son, by default raises his status. But he knows if he raises his status too high, that he begins to become a threat and not somebody that's seizing power. So what he does is he says, oh yeah, deify my dad, but not me. I'm merely the son of a god, not truly God. Brilliant. Third thing he does, something Julius Caesar didn't do very well. I am the dictator for life. Dead. See? Number three, the accolades he does accept, he does begrudgingly and very shrewdly. In 27 BC, in addition to the name Caesar, he receives the name Augustus. This is whenever Octavian no longer really exists and Augustus exists. 27 BC. The moniker Augustus is added. Augustus means, the Greek word for it is Sebastos. I'll transliterate it. You'll see this actually a lot in inscriptions if you go over into Asia Minor, etc. Sebastos, same word for Augustus, but it's just Augustus is Latin, Sebastos is Greek. It means his reverence or his worship. And it has divine undertones, but it falls short of calling him God. You see how that works? It points to divinity. There's a trajectory of deity, but it doesn't. It actually falls short of getting to deification. His reverence or his worship. So there's a relationship, a trajectory towards deification, but it stops short of being called a god. 27 BC. In addition, not only that, not only was it intended to point to some divine undertones, but it was also intended to connote sovereignty or sovereign rule. Same thing that the word dictator meant, but he would never take the word dictator for himself because of what happened to other people. Instead, what it really just means is the sovereign ruler, his worship, his reverence. So it's an honorific title that puts him above everyone else, and yet it doesn't put him to the level that could get him killed. He's like, okay, I'll accept this, I guess, if it will be the best thing for the state. Everything. Matter of fact, this is at the time period when the imperial cult began to develop, obviously with the establishment of Caesar as deity. And Augustus was only, as a matter of fact, in some pockets of the empire, he allowed himself to be worshipped as the Son of God. But he kept telling the state, the only reason why I'm doing that is to unify our diverse empire. It's a political tool. It's not a religious one. But he allowed the religion to begin to develop because he was saying, when we conquer all these people and they have all these different deities and they have all these different religions, how do we unify them? One of the ways you could do it is you could have a cult that all of them have to fall under, even if they have their own individual cults. And everybody was like, yeah, we'll worship Caesar. Why? He was dead. Cruelly, cruelly killed. And I'm merely the Son of God, but that's only a political tool, state. I'm not actually trying to gain more power than what I really know I have. Okay, we will talk about the implications of that and how that developed on Tuesday, which really will be quite short discussion. I'll be asking you about your emperor and what some of the characteristics that strike you, and then we'll talk about Roman society.